This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got. Wildlife Control Supplies. Proven solutions for wildlife control. Delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company. Have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you.
Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Welcome to Trapping Across America. This is your host, Clint Locklear. Broadcasting from the PCG compound in the Appalachian Mountains of Tennessee. And I'm going to have a show where I'm going to start something and I'm going to finish it next week probably. Pretty sure I will. And it's a letter that I got from a 16-year-old trapper that I've had for a couple of weeks. And we did the clean acquisition show last week. And then we're doing it this week. And what I'm actually doing, to be honest with you, it's called strategic procrastination, because I understand I'm talking to a 16-year-old on this letter, and it'd be a lot different if it was another 40-year-old man or something like that. So I want to make sure that the advice that I give him is what I want it to be. So I was going to do that today. I'm going to do part of something about that today. So, Wyatt, I appreciate your letter. I have way more respect for you than you realize, man. And you'll see why next week when we get in this letter more. But we're going to start with a few things about that. And you'll see why that is. And it's one of those, this can be a motivational type thing, and it can be very educational at the same time when we get into that. And some of the stuff today, because when I start talking about a new podcast I've been listening to, which is Team Never Quit, it'll lead in to next week. So, you know, just keep these two things in mind if you would. I do have an interesting question that I want to start with that is about dog hunters. And this is a pretty interesting one this is from Jesse. And I've noticed an increase in coyote hunters in the past year due to the coyote crisis. Seems everyone has a dog box in their truck. The crew around my house and I get along well. I've caught their dogs a couple of times, just throw them in the truck and take them back to their pens. The hunters are always appreciative, and they always tell me there's a spot for you in a truck anytime you want to hunt with us. But some guys aren't so nice, like with Jeff Dunlap in Louisiana last year. It's a broad question, but what do you recommend trappers to do to get along with coyote hunters? It works out for me because I trap a bit more yotes in the fall when the coyote guys aren't out, and then I focus just on cooning the winter with dog proofs. I also think it's an important topic for young trappers to think about, who might think they're all that and might piss off the wrong people, like the people who might turn you into the next bait pile kind of people. Now the next question is, and I don't have an answer for this, but it's one I've wondered myself. This isn't a big question, but it always bugged me. Why the hell do coons like to crap on porches, steps, and elevated deer blinds? Just curious. Why they feel the need to be up there to take a dump. It means a great deal for me when seasons, it means it's great for me when the season comes, just curious. Thanks for your time and have a good one. The thing about the coon, I really don't know. I guess they're kind of like us in a way. You know, people like to live on the tops of mountains so they can see off in the valley. Heck, I don't know. I do know that when I go to a lot of times, a new place that I'm doing predator work, and if coons are involved with that, the first thing I ask them, do you have any bridges, docks, shooting platforms, anything like that? And then that's one of the first places I go look. And then it's really hard a lot of times to set traps on those elevated things. You can with the dog proofs now, there's no doubt about that. But you also got to keep in mind, if you nail a coon on that, he's going to be sitting up there, and there's a good chance he's going to tear that deck apart. I mean, not like take the woods and the screws off, but I mean, it'll look pretty nasty. So what I normally do is I will look at that and try to figure out how the coon are getting to that particular object. Down in Texas, there's several of these ponds on one of the ranches we've been to for years, and they have docks almost on all of them. And you can't go out there without almost falling down in coon crap. You absolutely can't. So normally what I'll do is I'll get where the dog proof and the coon are just out of reach, and I'll try to figure out, you know, is there a trail or not a trail. But the funny thing about those locations, they've never been really, really high volume catches for me. And I don't know why, and I wish I did, but I don't. There's a lot of sign, and you can see the sign has been there forever. Now, I don't know if it's kind of like, you know, you go get a great big, for you guys in the South, crystals, or maybe most of y'all know what Captain D's are, where it's just really greasy fish. And when you got to go to the bathroom, you got to go to the bathroom. And you ain't stopping just because there's something there that catches your attention or maybe you want to eat. You've got a mission. maybe that's the reason these places aren't that productive. I really don't know. But yeah, I catch some coon there, but it's not a big deal. But what it does, it allows me to see, because I mean, those are usually resident coons that are there, and they've been there generationally. And then what I'm looking for is the ditches or the cover or the tree lines or the fence lines or something like that. And that gives me almost like a beginning of a framework to start piecing out how these coons are going. Because doing, you know, I know this wasn't about predator control, but just going out and setting coon traps on a predator control group or predator control job is not always the most efficient. I mean, it's just not. So you need to try to figure out how the coon are working in an area. Because coons do different things in certain areas. I was given a instruction up in Wisconsin, and the dangest thing I've ever seen, every single coon trail we found was 20 foot off the culvert. So if you went and set the culvert, you're missing all the coon, which was part of the reason I was up there. Why were they doing that? I don't have any idea. But after about an hour of seeing that over and over again, we could find coon trails really quick because we found the framework of how those coons are going through an area. That you I've been in certain places where coons don't seem to like going out across any type of open ground, probably because of hunters shooting at them or something like that. You know, they stick to right on the edges. And then once you kind of figure that out, you've got a framework to start looking for locations. But just going out and plopping a bunch of traps out a lot of times is not the most advantageous on a job like that. So, you know, knowing where these places are good, it'll help you set up a framework kind of, but it's not always going to be the most productive thing in the world. So, you know, keep that in mind. And the thing about the coyote dogs, this is a tough question. And for you younger trappers out there that you know, think you're 12 foot tall and bulletproof because you can holler and scream at people on the internet, and a lot of adults that you're really disrespectful to probably don't just snatch you up and break your nose because of the quote civilized world we live in. This is something you need to pay attention to, because there's times in life that you're going to get outside of the first world bubble that we all live in. And as a young person, until you get outside that bubble and someone smacks that nose for you, you really don't know that you're in the bubble to begin with. So pay attention to what I'm getting ready to say, because if you've been listening to me any amount of time, I'm not a back down kind of guy. I'm just not. It's not in my DNA very much. I'm very low key. Anybody that knows me, you know, on a day-to-day basis, I'm very laid back. I don't get, you know, very excited. I think about things before I make a decision and stuff like that. But there's certain things that I have a hard time with. One of them are bullies. And you'll see a 300-pound Appalachian full-blooded American male get righteous really quick when I come in contact with bullies. And a lot of times when you're dealing with the dog hunters that I've dealt with in the past, that's exactly what you're dealing with. And more than that, they don't live in the same, a lot of times, and this is going to be different. And now I'm using more of my experience here in the Appalachians and a lot of the bear hunters and the hog hunters and stuff like that. That's not people that you want to mess with, because they don't live in the same world that me and you live with as far as what's right or wrong or retribution or justice. And whether it's right or wrong for them to be like that is irrelevant. What the law says is irrelevant. And if you're going to go head-to-head with these guys, you need to understand it's not a movie. There's not a rewind switch on the game. You don't get to just start over. Things can get really serious really quick. Just like Jeff down in Louisiana. He's making a coyote set. Next thing he knows, he's surrounded and guns drawn on him. And you know, I'm surprised they didn't flatten his tires or do all kind of crazy stuff when they were down there, because I'm using my experience of being around a lot of the dog hunters that I have been around. Not so much coon hunters, but and some of the coon hunters have been pretty bad. But I mean, like, especially the hog and the bear. And see, I don't know that much about the coyote hunters, because that's just not something. I live in really, really thick country, and to go chase coyotes with dogs is probably not going to be that effective. So I don't have to deal with that. So I don't know the cultural or the character makeup when it comes to coyote hunters. But after Jeff's experience, I'm kind of putting them more towards the really deep woods, you know, back in the 1700 mentality bear and hawk hunters that I've had a lot of experience with here in Tennessee. So, you know, keep that in mind. So sometimes, especially for a new trapper, and I think this is important, what is right or wrong is irrelevant at the time. It's kind of like if you lived in New York City and the mafia controlled your block where you had your business, it's not right for them to come take 20% of your money. But if you don't, you're probably going to end up feeding some fishes somewhere out in the bay or swamp somewhere with a 22 to your ear. See, that's the reality of living on that block. Right or wrong, doesn't have anything to do with it. And there's usually more of them than there is of you. Just like with a mafia. You can take care of a mafia problem, but then you're going to have a whole mafia problem, if you get what I'm saying. So keep that stuff in mind. Now, my first rule, when I deal with anybody, and I do mean this with anybody, is I have a philosophy way of dealing with people. And, you know, and it's kind of like, you know, when Martin Luther King talked about judging a man not on the color of his skin but his character, one of the wisest things that's ever been said at a political rally. That is absolutely true. The other part of that is, from a philosophical point of view, I treat every human that I come in with the most up amount of respect and niceness that I can. And then the ball's in their court. So what that means is, if I come across a bunch of dog hunters, I'm not going to get aggressive or snappy or smart aleck or, you know, I have as much right to be out here as you or anything like that. I'm just going to start a conversation, just like they were going to be my best friends come tomorrow morning, because they may be, I don't know. But what I'm doing is I'm judging that person on their character. This is a conscious decision that I make when I meet people. And then the ball is in their court. Now, how they do, how they react to the situation past that point is how I then treat or think of them from that point on. And this is not just in, and this is for every age trapper. If you do this, all of a sudden you'll have a better judge of character of who you're dealing with. So if I meet, like I've met some dog hunters before, I wasn't apprehensive, I wasn't aggressive, I wasn't, have my hand on my 45 or nothing like that, because I didn't know what was going on. I just treated them like they're going to be tomorrow's best friend. So if they react and start acting very aggressive towards me, and they're very disrespectful towards me, that is the way that I personally, if safety is not the big issue here, is I'm going to respond to them. And the way that the reason that I say that, if and think about it, no human has the right. Now keep in mind, a bully to me needs to have his out of the gene pool. But how one person treats another person says a lot about how they are. And if you go about it in any other way than what I'm telling you, I don't know how you're not taking the humanity away from yourself of being a free man, if you think of yourself that way. So if they're nice, I'm nice. Or I'm nice, and if they're nice, I'm nice. You know, and most of the time, you kind of work it out. You know, there could be a little bit of apprehension on their part because they're worried about their dogs. Don't jump into a conclusion really quick. Just talk it out. You know, where do y'all guys live? So, if, you know, something ever happens, and I were to catch one of your dogs, where can I bring it? Or is there a cell phone that I can call you? Or do you know how to open the trap so you can let your dog out? And you know, we put the laminations in the offset so it doesn't hurt your dog and different things like that. Most reasonable people at that time will start treating you the way that they're treating you. But there is just bad people in the world. Are there? They're not. I don't know if I would say just bad. They're just peckerheads. And it, to me, if you sit there and you keep trying to be nice while they berate you, tell me the difference between that in a marriage where a man's just beating on his wife all the time and the wife takes it. See, if we put it in the next exaggerated stage, it becomes pretty silly at that point to allow that to happen. Now, if you're a young guy and someone's being a peckerhead to you about trapping and they've got dogs, take my advice, get your stuff, and get out of there. Because even if you're 19 or 22 or 23 years old, and if your dad has never told you this, I'm going to give you one of the hardest lessons that you can learn through personal experience that you don't have to have in real life. You are not a man at 16, 18, or 22 years old. You're not. You're not physically a man, and you're not mentally a man. And if you get in a physical altercation with a man at that time, and he's a real man, you're going to have a bad day. Because you're not mentally tough enough yet, and you're not physically strong enough yet to even defend yourself. And it's not like a movie or a video game when that crap happens. It ain't like it is on YouTube where you get to just switch to a new video. So, you know, keep that in mind. If you're young and the guys are aggressive towards you, get your stuff and get out. It's not worth it. You can go to your game warden if you want to. I doubt you're going to get very much help there. I may be surprised. But it sometimes it's just not worth it because you're in a situation that is completely out of your control at this time. So keep that in your mind. The way, like I said, if I know there's a certain area that dog hunters are going all the time and are during the season, like here, our hog season, when they have what we call party hunts here in Tennessee, which are like these great big gangs of 75 people with their dogs, and there's two or three of these party groups, and they're running all over parts of the mountains, it's not worth going up there and trying to trap. Now, is it legal for me to trap at that time? Yes, it is. But the heartache that that's probably going to bring is not worth it. So when I know that those are coming up, I pull stuff or I go somewhere else. You know, it's not strength all the time just to get in a pissing match. Strength is a lot of times staying out of the match, you know, because why do you want to, you're going to be mad, you're going to start making bad decisions, it's going to ruin your day, you're going to start thinking vindictive thoughts, that's going to lead you into a bad mood. Why even go there? So just pull it up and leave. If you know that the coyote guys are doing it in the snow, like the guy that sent me this does, and you switch over to something else, a lot of times that'll stop that problem. You know, if you can't come up with a reckoning of this. Like around here, I've got some guys that I know coon hunt on the river. If I'm going to go set snares on the river, I'll let them know. I will tell them I'm going to be there from the 1st of January to the 20th of January on the river. After the 20th, I'm going to pull my stuff and y'all can go back to raising cane on the river and we won't have any issues whatsoever. And that works out very well. There's some guys that I've tried to work that out with and they went automatically into, if you catch my dog, I'm going to burn your house and this, that, and the other. And that's when they realized that wasn't the smartest move for them to ever do with me personally. But there again, I'm 47 years old, 6'2", 300 pounds, ex-military, and Scottish descent. So you can imagine where that leads to really quick when I start getting threatened. If you're young, just say, you know, sorry, this was a problem, and leave. So use your head also. Now, it's the same thing. You know, you may think, well, that's letting them get over on me or whatever. Well, see, that's a modern society's way of nonsense, of thinking that way. It's the same thing. If you're out in Nebraska or South Dakota or something like that, and the road ditches turn orange with hunters and dogs for 2 weeks out of the year for pheasant, and you're going to start going out and trying to run traps in the road ditch, you are asking for trouble. Now, is it legal for you to do it? Yes. Does that mean you should do it? I don't think it's very smart. you know, that's where you get some permission, get off the roads where people aren't going to be hunting at that time, go do your thing and come back to the roads. It just makes life easier when you think about things like that way. Same thing in deer hunting. You know, some of the stories I've heard of Pennsylvania and Michigan on opening day of season, why in the world would you want to have a trap out in the middle of that madness? You know your traps are going to get stolen, your coyotes are going to get shot, you're going to be pissed off and mad and hating deer hunters and all that. It'd be better off just to jerk them things out and go do something else while that madness is going on, then go back and do your own thing. You know, it just makes better sense that way. You know, my advice is don't try to make it confrontational because you think it's going to be confrontational. Because all of us are great fictional writers in our heads. We think about having a problem with a dog hunter, we can write a whole novel about how it's going to go. And in reality, it doesn't happen that way. And we can get all worked up over the novel that we wrote in our head that hasn't happened. And so you in your mind, you think that's the way it's going to happen and you react a certain way. You know, are there bad dog hunters? Yes. Are there good dog hunters? I have no doubt. So just use your common sense and try not to get in a confrontation if you can help it. Because the only thing that happens with that, when you get in a confrontation like that, and you're going to prove to them that you're going to trap no matter what, it's going to go downhill. Now, how far it goes downhill is going to depend on you and them. And half of that equation, guys, is out of your control. So you don't know how that is. I mean, is it worth it if all of a sudden everywhere you go your truck tires are cut? Well, I mean, you can prove to them that you ain't leaving and you're going to spend $4,000 on tires. Well, who really won that? I'll let you decide that. You know, so just keep that in mind. And when you're dealing with groups of people, like Jeff did, groups of people are very tribal. And tribes are very easy to turn into mobs. And when mobs get worked up, they do really stupid things. And trappers, for the most part, are singular in nature. Maybe you and a buddy. So if you come across 10 or 15 other guys and y'all start yakking back and forth, pointing fingers and shoving, you're going to be dealing with a mob. When a mob starts acting crazy, just go look at some of the riots that's going on. Most of those people don't have the courage to do what they do at a riot if it was just them. But you put them in a group and they feel like they can get away with anything. So keep all that stuff in mind if you come across the dog hunters. But the best way to handle it is treat them with the utmost respect and then figure out where to go from there. So that's where we're going to go. Now, the thing that's leading into what I'm gonna do next week, it's going to be a little bit more of aggressive of a show, I'm pretty sure, because I get pretty fired up on subjects like this. But I've been listening to a new podcast, and guys, I'm telling you, you need to listen to it. It is awesome. It is highly motivational. It is entertaining. It is funny. And it is educational all at the same time. And it's called Team Never Quit. I've had some guys email me. I had some guys talk to me about it at the Kansas show. It's a great thing. Team Never Quit. Now, if you've ever seen the movie Lone Survivor or read the book, Marcus Luttrell is the SEAL that all that was written about. He's one of the guys that's doing this post. The other guy that's doing it is another SEAL. And it's basically about a never quit mentality. And it is really cool what they do. And I'm going to give you some examples here in a minute. But that got me thinking. You know, when I was having to catch so much fur just to pay bills, I mean, I went out about it from a military point of view to the point of dang near insanity from looking at it now. Stuff that you would have a hard time getting me to bite off now, I did not even slow down. It was just rolling. And part of that was from this never quit mentality. The Wyatt that sent me this letter at age 16, you know, that usually comes with age a little bit. Mental toughness is something you decide to have. and you work on it all the time, and this never quit comes from that mental toughness. And a lot of adults still don't have any mental toughness. Any type of thing that gets uncomfortable, they run away from and stuff like that, physically or mentally, and they're just not mentally tough whatsoever. And for what, when we start going over this letter, you'll see why we're talking about this, because he brings this point up to me. So mental toughness is a big deal. If you're going to set a goal that's going to be in trapping or anything else, I don't care what it is, if you're going to set that goal, you're going to have to be mental tough when you go about do that. And that's a lot of the stuff that they talk about in this podcast, Team Never Quit, with Marcus Luttrell. And one of the things that this podcast does is they ask these questions that are amazing to me, the stories that people give. And what it is, it's your never quit moment. Where in your life did it actually become a never quit moment? And see, that's part of mental toughness. And unfortunately, there's a lot of adults today that have never even had a never quit moment because they just quit or they never start, you know, which is kind of sad, to be honest with you. But I've really thought about that. What is a never quit moment in my life? And I'm going to tell you a story about that. And I'm also going to tell you one about a drill sergeant that I had and got to know later after basic and AIT, which is Drill Sergeant Leach, which I'm going to talk about. And then I'm going to put that in a trapping reference with Johnny Thorpe. And this is kind of like, what they're talking about on Team Never Quit. So you kind of get a grasp where you get over there. Because it is really cool what they talk about over there. Now, this is one of the things that they talk about. And this was on today's podcast I listened to, which was probably a week old or whatever. But when we're going through trapping, let's say you have a goal of you want to catch 100 coon or 1,000 coon. Or you want to go out and go from 100 coyotes to 200 coyotes. Well, you're going to have struggle in that. And it's okay to struggle. I mean, it really is. Because if you ain't struggling, you ain't doing nothing. And, so what that is. And they bring up these historical figures a lot of times where they're talking about people that either voluntary or involuntary struggle. And this example they gave on this podcast I just listened to, it's freaking mind-blowing. And as I'm going through this list that I learned about on Team Never Quit, I want you to think about your trapping. So when you think it's too hard, too cold, too wet, or too muddy, you're too tired, you know, your eyes are bloodshot, you ain't got enough sleep, I want you to think about this. Because these are real people we're going to be talking about that's done what we're getting ready to talk about. And what it is, it's the Tendai Buddhist monks. Now, these are Japanese monks. And what they do is for enlightenment. To me, it's like completely destroying your body to figure out what you're here for or something like that. So whatever you think enlightenment is or whatever they thought it was, that was the goal of what they were doing, trying to get enlightenment. Some people call them marathon monks, which you're getting ready to see. And to be one of these, I mean, you know, the SEALs or Rangers or Delta Force or all that we look up to in America, dude, that ain't nothing compared to what these guys did. And there's been 400 of them in the last, 3,000 years pull this off. It's a really big deal. So in that culture, it's a really big deal. I think they're personally crazy. But when you're thinking about your trapping and you start whining and the little devil's on your shoulder and he's telling you it ain't worth it and this, that, and the other, think about this story about what these guys did for enlightenment. It's a 1,000-day challenge that they had to do. And they're pushing their body. And you'll never do this in trapping. I mean, this hard. But, I mean, to think about what the human body and the mental capacity of a human is absolutely amazing. So it's a 1,000-day challenge spread out over 7 years. Takes 7 years to be one of these Tendai Buddhist monks. For the first year, you have to run 18 miles for 100 days straight. For the second year, you run 18 miles for 100 days straight. On the third year, you run 18 miles for 100 days straight. Now, on the fourth year, you run 18 miles for 200 days straight. Now, that's like three quarters of a year. 18 miles a day. That's no days off, you know, no soaking in the hot tub with a Bengay or nothing like that. On day five, 200 days, 18 miles. Now, after they do the fifth year, they've got a ceremony they got to live through. 9 days after they finish the last 200 days of 18 miles, they can't eat, they can't drink, and they can't sleep. It's like their version of a 9-day hell week after they've done been through hell week. And they got monks that sit there with little canes. If they start falling asleep, they smack them in the head. If they try to go get something to drink, they beat on them. I mean, it is almost just like hell week, you know, for that to happen. So they go through this 9-day of no food, no water, no rest after they destroyed their body. On year six, they have to run 37 miles a day for 100 straight days. Year seven, they got to run 52 miles a day for 100 days. And then to finish that up, the rest of the year, they've got to run 18 miles for 100 days. And they become these marathon monks, you know. And it was such a big deal at the time, and this is going to seem strange to you, in our culture, but they were the only people in all of Japan that could wear sandals in front of an emperor. That's when someone put their body through that in the level of enlightenment that they should have had by that point. The emperor didn't even make them take their shoes off. Everybody else did. But see, to make this even more compelling about what they were doing, you can quit the first year. There's no shame in quitting the first year. After the first year, after you run 18 miles for 100 days, if you quit after that first year, you don't get to quit. So when you make this type of dedication to be one of these monks, it's life or death from after the first year. If they quit anywhere between year two and year seven, they have to take their own life when they quit on what they're considering their journey or running for that many miles. So you know after year two, you're going to die if you quit. You're committed to the point of no end. And those are monks. And we're going to whine and complain and feel sorry for ourselves during trapping season? Seriously? I mean, that's ridiculous. If you put that in perspective of what people get upset about and get down in the mouth about during trapping season. Now, that's one of the historical things they brought up on Team Never Quit. The other thing is they go, what is your no-quit moment? And I've really thought about it because I've been listening to it now for about 2 weeks. It's not that old of a podcast. So I've been sitting there and I've been going, I'm thinking about trapping things. I'm thinking about the military and all that. I'm going to tell you probably my never quit moment. And this probably had a lot to do with the mental toughness of to do what I used to do when I was younger. And it's not about trapping whatsoever. It's actually about football. Now, I was very athletic in high school. Now, keep in mind, I made money arm wrestling, hustling black people in basketball, and I got a football scholarship to a private school my senior year in high school, which was a bad deal because I barely got out of there graduating because that was way above my level at the time. After that, I didn't really know what to do. I joined up with the military. I didn't have a concrete date when I was going in. It was going to be late fall, early winter. And then, you know, I'm kind of bouncing around. I met Cindy at the time. And then I meet a couple of guys that know a guy that plays semi-pro football. And I didn't know what that was. I mean, you still don't hear about it. I'm assuming they still do that. You know, you don't really know what it is. So that kind of got my curiosity up. I'm kind of bouncing around. I like playing football. So I go down there. I talk to the coach. I'm standing about, like I said, at that time, 6'2", probably 270, lifting lots of weights. I'm not the roly-poly then that I am now. And, you know, very good athletic ability. And he said, sure, if you want to try out, you can try out. And that was about it. You know, it was kind of like, yeah, whatever, come down and try out. Well, I couldn't play defense anymore because my shoulders come out of socket so much that I couldn't do that. So I could play offense, and what I play was center. So I'm the dude snapping the ball. Now, the guy that was in front of me played for was a starter at the University of Arkansas. So I had to beat him out of position to even play in a game, which I did. So there I am. I go down to Alabama, and we're at a high school football field, and there's athletes. Now, what semi-pro, what I've learned what that was at the time, some of these guys just want to play football. Some of them didn't make it in the draft, or they didn't make it on a team when they walked on, like the Falcons or something like that, which is actually what we were associated with. And this was their way to prove that they deserved to be in the NFL. So this was not like a sandlot football. For some people it was, they just enjoyed it, but some people it was like life or death and they wanted to make the money. So it was a different level, way different than high school was for me. I come out of high school. What are you at high school, 18 years old? And now I'm dealing with men that's already graduated college. So keep this in mind as I tell this little bitty story. So the first game, now we practiced full pads, all that stuff, and that was rough, guys. I'm telling you, in high school, most of the time, you have a hit that you get hit or you hit somebody maybe once every three or four games that it is really just a slobber knocker type hit. During practice, that's near about dang every play. And I knew something was different when we started warm-ups at our first game, and I hit harder and was hit harder than I ever was in high school during the warm-ups of semi-pro football. There was a different level of intensity that I have never experienced at that time. And I'll be honest with you, it spooked me. Because guys that I've been hitting this whole time, all of a sudden they started feeling like they weighed like 700 pounds of solid muscle. So I knew before the first kickoff, something was crazy different about the situation I was finding myself into. So we go out, they kick off. I'm not on the kickoff team or the returning team. I am the starting center at this time. I get down and I look up, and the only way I can describe what I saw, absolutely, to be honest with you, made me think, what in the world am I doing here? Because I'm leaning down over the ball. We're running a play to the left. They're running a three linebacker set. So the guy's in front of me, and I don't have a nose guard. So we're running. My job is to get to the linebacker. I'm looking at a physique on a black guy that was made out of solid marble with muscles on top of muscles. And his nose is flaring back and forth like a big Brahma bull. And his eyes look like he's had like 45 hits of speed. And he was bigger than me. And I would almost guess he was faster than me. And I'll never forget the first snap of the first game. When I hacked that ball and I finally got a little bit of leverage to get in front of him and we collided, it was almost like I got hit, literally, by a full-size truck that was going like 20 miles an hour. It folded me up, and I mean, I hit the ground as hard as he hit me. I couldn't breathe. And like I said, well, I'm being honest here. It scared the living crap out of me. Never seen or felt anything like that in my life. I went back to that huddle, trying to catch my breath. And somewhere between that huddle and that next step of the ball, I can tell you was one of my, if not the most, never quit moments in my life. Because I remember turning around and looking at him, and he was still just as big, just as spazzed out, and just as strong as he was 30 seconds ago when he knocked me on the ground. I made up my mind right then I was going to pummel him into submission one way or another. Within the rules or without the rules, when we left that field at the end of that game, he was not going to ever want to see me again. And let me tell you, I keep in mind now, once my mind got set on that, I was jumping off sides and I'm the center. I wanted after his butt so bad. I was going offside and I'm the one that's supposed to snap the ball.
And it was very confusing for the coach. He didn't know what in the world was going on. But he knew that there was a freaking battle going out there between me and that linebacker. And I mean, we crashed and fought and hit and pinched and kicked. And if we could bite, I guarantee we'd have bit each other all night long. He was as determined to show me that I wasn't going to whoop him as I was determined to show him that I was going to whoop him. And I've never lived through anything like that in my life. Now, the best part about this story to me is about halfway through the fourth quarter, he started trying to get away from me. Either from because it was like a little tenacious gnat that was just fluttering around him all the time, or he was starting to feel the same pain that I was. I have no idea. And that, in my mind, was probably one of the most turning points in my life. If you set your mind to something, like Johnny Thorpe always said, come hell or high water, if you do that and you set your mind to it, by God, you can do it. And to tell you how bad it cost me to go through that moment, at the time, I only had a 900 Ninja. That was my only vehicle. When we got back off the bus at like 3 o'clock in the morning, my head was so swole up from hitting that hard that many times, I could not even put my motorcycle helmet on. I had to sit under a tree till like 9 the next morning till the swelling went down so I could put my motorcycle helmet on. That's honest to God true story. So to me, that is a never quit moment. You know, but part of that is mental toughness. That's why if someone tells me I can't do something in trapping, really? I can't do something in business? Really? I mean, you know, I'm not looking at a challenge inside of trapping where I've got a 6'4", 250-pound solid muscle black linebacker that's blowing snot bubbles out because he's just, you know, enraged for being there for some reason. No, I'm talking about trapping or something to do with business. No, that doesn't scare me. I mean, if I could battle with that dude all night long and come out somewhat victorious, I can do whatever I want to in trapping. Tell me I can't. There's no way. So that's my moment. But I want to tell you a story about a gentleman that I met in the Army. And I'm using the word gentlemanly very loosely. He was a drill sergeant that I had when I was in basic training. And he's the typical, just like you see on Full Metal Jacket, he's probably studied that film 1,000 times. He was old school. He was loud. He was aggressive. He loved getting in your face. He loved throwing all your crap out the third story window in the barracks. I mean, he was having marital problems, which I come to find out later, during our basic training session, which made him even that much more pissed off as a human being. So we didn't have a regular drill sergeant. We had drill sergeant that was just pissed off at the world. So, I mean, he was rough. He even tried to physically start a fight with a guy that I was in basic training with that started for UT but then got busted for drugs, didn't know what to do, so he went in the Army. So this was kind of like the guy that I played football against, except he was bigger and more muscular than him. He was so mad at the world, he tried to start a fight with him. But so that's the type of personality Drill Sergeant Leach was. But there was something I remember about him. When we would go do PT, he would completely come unhinged when somebody quit. I mean completely unhinged. You know, when I was in, it's not like you see in the old movies where they can just beat the snot out of you. It's not like that. Now, they will put hands on you, rest assured of that. But it's not the same as it is when you look at some of the Full Metal Jacket stuff or some of those movies or talk to some of the old-timers. The world started moving on a little bit since then. But he would come unhinged. And once we got into basic training and we went through AIT, and that's, I don't know how many weeks or months that was. It seemed like an eternity at the time. We had to wait for our airborne training, so we were what we called holdovers. So we didn't really have anywhere to go, and it was like 3 weeks. So the drill sergeants had to babysit us, which you can imagine how that made them feel. So we just did PT and details and picked up cigarette butts and stuff like that. We really didn't do any training. It was just pretty much physical training to get ready for airborne school before we went in, which I'm grateful we did, because airborne school was quite easy, because it was much easier than the holdover status that we had with Drill Sergeant Leach. Now, Drill Sergeant Leach and another one of the drill sergeants at the time were both black hats. And in the Army, you know what a black hat is. He's the instructor that runs jump school. I mean, you know, instead of drill sergeants, they call them black hats, and they seem to find the most nastiest people in the world to do that. So he did his tour with the being a black hat. He went to drill sergeant. We had him hold over and this, that, and the other. Well, once holdover started, that's when a lot of the nonsense harassment started slowing down a little bit in the Army. And you got to have conversations with some of the drill sergeants. They'd talk to you about stuff, and, you know, about jump school and ranger school and, you know, different deployments and stuff like that. So that was actually kind of cool. But we got to talking, and we were going to airborne school. And we had a guy that thought he was literally reincarnated. I guess he was a Buddhist. He literally thought he was a reincarnated ranger from World War II, which was kind of curious if you know about the history of the Rangers. But he literally thought, and he thought he was also in Vietnam and got killed. So he was off his rocker, but that's all he thought he was going to do his whole life. And we were doing an obstacle course after, I don't know what the amount of the run was, and then we were going to do a PT test. And they were just screwing with us to screw with us. And it was not a very fun day, to be honest with you. But he quit. He quit doing the obstacle course and just sat down. And Drill Sergeant Leach, I mean, I thought he was literally going to grab him around his neck till his eyeballs came out of their sockets. I mean, he went just crazy. He's calling him... I can't say what he was calling him, but it was rough. Later that night, he came by and was checking on us and just jumped that dude's butt again. And then he gathered everybody around and he goes, "Y'all are so freaking soft and weak, you don't even know it." He said, you know, in this, that, and the other, he said, "You run, you can't run anymore. If you can sit down, then you're not done running," and this, that, and the other. And it was a weird conversation. The next day, Drill Sergeant Medina explained Drill Sergeant Leach to us. Now, he said Drill Sergeant Leach has been put in the hospital 4 times that he knows of since he's known him. Now, why has he been put in the hospital? Because he will not quit when he's doing a mission or when he's exercising. So if he sets a goal of running 12 miles at a certain amount of pace, he's either going to finish it or he's going to pass out. The rest comes when you finish or you're going to pass out. And he's passed out 4 times, and they actually had to take him to the hospital on. I got to know Drill Sergeant Leach because when I was in Alaska, I was in G3 training. It had to do with the schools, and he was up there for something that was going on, and we just happened to run into each other. So, and we were completely out of the basic training and, you know, the screwing around that happened, you know, and it was a lot different. So I got to talking with him. And I just asked him, like, why did you, you know, I told him what George Harper did. I said, why did you get so crazy when somebody quit? And he kind of just, you know, shuffled around a little bit. And he said, well, let me tell you a story about not quitting. He said, and if you're not ready to push yourself to the limit when you need to, and he said, that's all mental toughness. When you quit on a run, that's because you're being weak. Because most of the time, your body doesn't quit. Your mind quits. The reason he was no longer in jump school is some guys went out the door. They got tangled up. They're sitting outside the door, and they're getting their brains beat out at 700 feet over Fort Benning, Georgia. And being a black hat, they couldn't land the airplane because it would have killed the students. So Drill Sergeant Leach hooked up to a cable, climbed out on the parachute line outside of the airplane, and was trying to dislodge those two guys that are tangled up, getting beat to death on the outside. And they were unconscious, apparently, from what he was saying by the time he even got to them. And he was afraid that their heads were going to get crushed on the airplane. He said, my adrenaline was going. My mission at that time was to get them, and he's calling his kids at that time, get the kids off the line. He crawls out where he's hooked into around his waist, which I'm sure broke every safety law in the book. He gets them out there, and he gets them undone. Now, for him to get them undone, he broke his legs and dislocated both of his shoulders. Never quit. And he looked at me and he said, if I wouldn't have been as mentally tough as I made myself being a soldier and never allow myself to quit, those two kids would have died. He said, I knew my shoulders were out of socket and I was pretty sure my leg was broke. And he said, I still had to get them off that line. He said, weak people quit. Men never quit. And I'll never forget that. I mean, he pushed everybody the way he pushed himself because he saw that sometimes you got to be able to push yourself. And you may be saying, what's that got to do with trapping, Clint? It's got everything to freaking do with trapping. If you set a goal or you want to go do something or you're going to be a professional trapper or whatever it is, and it doesn't have to do with trapping, if you learn to push yourself beyond being uncomfortable, all of a sudden then, really, some really cool things start happening. And and if you talk to Johnny Thorpe, well, you can't now because he's passed, but I got to spend, I'll never forget it. There was one of the nights I was taking instruction, we was drinking on some of that treat, that cheap whiskey that he would get. And we're sitting around the table and, we get to talking and I was curious about when he was young, what the trapping was like. I was dumbfounded at the discipline and mental toughness it took those guys to do what they did. They were walking in sometimes 20 and 30 miles all summer long carrying tents and bacon and flour and traps and stretchers and everything else. You know, that's a 60, you know, 40 to 60 mile round trip walking, carrying stuff. This is before the days of four-wheelers and all the other, you know, stuff that we take your, we don't even think about today. Then they would set up on that lake and they would trap for weeks or months. These are big lakes from what he was telling me. And they lived off of bacon and muskrat and this, that, and the other. And they did everything on foot. And it was, you know, butthole deep snow and breaking through ice and, you know, different things like that. Insanity compared to what we do today. The mental toughness. I can't even imagine what Johnny Thorpe thought about trapping as he got older, looking around, as soft as we've become, because we have. I mean, I can't even imagine that. So even in trapping, I'm not saying you need to go out and walk, you know, probably 200 miles carrying crap to get your camp set up, but just the mental toughness of even trappers used to have that nobody would do today. I mean, I ain't signing up for that gig. You know, I'm good. I don't need those muskrats that bad. But the mental toughness that they had was really cool. And with mental toughness, I'm going to say something that anybody in the military is going to know exactly what I'm talking about. And when you're thinking about mental toughness when it comes to your trapping, there's a phrase you need to learn. You need to burn this in your brain, guys. And it's called enjoy the suck. S-U-C-K. Enjoy the suck. There's a sadistic pleasure that happens when someone learns to enjoy the suck. That don't mean they're always happy about enjoying the suck, but they enjoy the suck. It separates them from other people. Most people you come in contact with don't even know what suck is. They've never done it. When you're on road marches in the military, like the Manchu March up in Alaska, which I absolutely hated. It was a yearly thing. You never did it except in February. It's freaking 20 to 30 below zero outside. And you got to go road march in full gear for 18 miles when it's that cold. If you fall out, you're probably going to die of hypothermia because you're sweating. I mean, you're trying to keep your skin from freezing and your body from not overheating. And it's just walking on ice for 18 miles. It sucked. But you know, when you got done with that, there was a feeling that there's no other way in the world to get it. You can't buy it. You can't take a drug for it. You can't do anything for it. And guys that did the Manchu March, you know, if you weren't in combat arms, you're probably going to get mad at what I'm getting ready to say. you know, we did not look at non-combat arms the same way because they did not do what we did. And we knew that they didn't do it, and we pretty much sure they couldn't do it because we knew what the suck was. And most of the time, the suck involved a rucksack. And it was just, it was pure misery. But when you got done with it, all of a sudden then, you've accomplished something. You know, like going through assault school, and you had to do the 12 miles and whatever that pace was that they were trying to say it was, and it was like twice as fast. Dude, that sucked. But you can get along with it. And then you got to be older in the military a little bit, and you got more mentally disciplined, and you got more mentally tough. And then the young guys that are in better shape than you and should be able to run rings around you, they're falling out left and right. All of a sudden, that suck was like a thing of pride. Now, if trappers or anybody else, well, whatever you're doing, if you learn that if you enjoy the suck, because the more that you figure out in life that sometimes you need to go through the suck before anything good happens. You know, like everybody here knows that I'm into permaculture. There's nothing that frustrates me more by a bunch of millennials out there that want to go start a permaculture system and play ring around the rosies and dance out through the fields and look at butterflies all day. And then they get frustrated and say, you can't build a system. No, it sucks to build a system. You go plant that many trees by hand, it sucks. You got to keep weeding that stuff, it sucks. You're going to dig swales and all that, it sucks. But the sucks gives you the part of the fulfillment at the end that you cannot get until you learn to enjoy the suck. So when you're out trapping and it gets a little bit of miserable, don't run away from it, guys. Enjoy the suck. Think about it. Imprint that in your mind. That's why at 300 pounds, I could probably trap rings around most guys. Most guys that come to take instruction, and you can talk to plenty of them, usually by before we're halfway through, they're exhausted. You know what? I enjoyed that. Maybe it was the sadistic part of me from the military. I kept pushing and going to new sets and new locations and talking about this and doing that and digging holes and this because I knew that everything in life is based off of your results are going to based on the suck. So I would push them. And then a lot of times I've had several of them go, I quit. I'm done. You know, that's all I want to do here. This is no longer fun. Okay, not a problem. And then I would sit back and I'd go, not much is going to happen with them because they don't know how to enjoy the suck. When you're out canoeing and you're tired and it's raining on you and you're soaking wet and it's like 1 degree off freezing, or it is freezing and you got ice building up on everything, you know, that should be something you should take pride in, not run away from. Now, if you're 16-year-old and listen to this, don't do that, you know, because you're going to get in a situation you're not going to handle. But if you're older, you're mature enough to be able to handle that situation, by all means, you know, jump in there both feet, because there's a sense of fulfillment that comes after the suck that you can't get any other way. In the mental toughness, guys, the more that the suck happens, all of a sudden then, that's when the good stuff starts happening. Because I can tell you, when you're at a convention, guys that's been through the trap and suck, there's no secret handshake. There's no little ring or decoder ring or a badge we wear. We know that instinctively from talking to other people. We know that. And all of it, most of the time, it's just a little nod. It's just a little look. It's just like, yep, yeah, we've been there. You know, you're a member of the I enjoy the suck of the trapping sometimes tribe. And all of a sudden, that gets really cool. So, you know, if you want to be a member of that club, you're going to have to go through the suck. And no matter what you do otherwise, without the suck, you'll never make it. You know, and it's a cool thing to be in, and I think everybody enjoyed it if they did. So I'm going to close this, and we're going to get really heavy into that letter next week.